Welcome to All In, a straight shooting, science-based podcast about periods, fertility, and nurturing health outside of unrealistic beauty expectations. We will mostly, but not exclusively, focus on hypothalamic amenorrhea, HA, a component of the female athlete triad and relative energy deficiency in sport.
I'm Dr. Nicola Rinaldi, scientist and lead author of the book No Period, Now What? I specialize in helping people understand how their eating, exercise, and lifestyle habits are keeping them from hormonal health and their best life. My work focuses on regaining periods, improving fertility, and breaking free of the rules of underlying diet culture. You can book an appointment to speak with me at noperiod.info/appointments and go to noperiod.info/support to join my new online community.
My name is Florence Gillet. I am a certified eating psychology coach and the founder of beyondbodyimage.com, as well as the French Instagram account aminoré_fr. I specialize in weight-inclusive mental and body image recovery. My goal is to help people let go of toxic weight and beauty beliefs to finally feel confident in their bodies.
Florence and I also offer a joint coaching package for people wishing to address different aspects of period recovery in a more personal way, accessible from both of our appointment sites.
Every 2 weeks, the All In podcast brings you real recovery stories, expert insights, and new scientific research on HA, hormonal health, and fertility, with an unmissable touch of body respect and women's empowerment.
Just a reminder that this podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and their guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. It's for informational purposes only. And because each person is so unique, please consult your primary health practitioner for any medical questions.
Music by the Andy Shulman Band, available on Spotify.
All right. Hello, everybody. This is Nicola here. And unfortunately, Florence was not able to join us today. She had a death in the family overnight, which is really sad. And so I'm sending all my love and best wishes out to her and her family. I am excited to be... Oh, one other thing. The recording might sound a little weird this week because I got COVID while I was out in California at my sister's house. So I do not have my normal microphone and headphones and everything. So... that would explain if the sound is a little off from normal. So I'm really excited today to bring you Dr. Cassandra Schufelt. She's a women's health internist with fellowship training in vascular biology and women's health and a certified menopause practitioner. She has several national and international leadership roles in the American College of Physicians, the European Menopause and Andropause Society, and the North American Menopause Society, where she's the current president of the society and on the board of trustees. She's co-authored several scientific position statements on menopause and hormone therapy. Dr. Schufelt has over 200 publications in the area of women's health and is involved with several large studies, including the Women's Ischemia Syndrome Evaluation, the Women's Health Initiative, the Los Angeles Atherosclerosis Study, and is the site PI for the Warrior Clinical Trial. So it's so nice to have you with us, Dr. Schufelt. And I'm really looking forward to chatting with you this morning because we've connected over the years and about some of the different studies that you've done. So I'm excited to talk to you about the work that you're doing now.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me and thank you for that introduction. And I think what you're doing here in terms of the support group and making a big footprint with boots on the ground in terms of helping women with this condition. And I was just saying that my research can only take me so far, but if I can't translate my research out to individual women, then we are not making an impact in this world. And so I, you know, commend you for chartering this. And I, as most of our interests are built out of own personal interest, you know, my passion for women's health is really there in terms of trying to make a difference in this world, you know, nationally and internationally for women's health. Mm-hmm. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. So could you tell us a little bit about where your interest in becoming a women's health physician with a special interest in cardiology came from, and then how that led you to examining heart health in people with amenorrhea?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I went into med school wanting to be a pediatrician. Like, I had no idea I was going to go into adult medicine until I rotated on pediatrics and realized that it's similar to having two patients because you've got the patient, the pediatric patient, and then you got the parent. So it was really quick that I learned I wanted to go into internal medicine. They always say when you enter medical school, you're either a surgeon or in going down the medicine pathway of internal medicine or other specialties. I knew I didn't want to be a surgeon. So I then entered into internal medicine residency. And pretty soon after entering internal medicine residency, I realized that I wanted to do women's health. And when I approached my program director, who's the director that kind of helps you set your career path, and it's somebody mm-hmm. who's counseling you, I mean, it was a group of three men. And when I said I wanted to go into women's health, and by all means, they are fantastic instructors and teachers and mentors, but they ended up rotating me through OBGYN. And I was thinking, scratching my head, going, if I wanted to do OBGYN, I probably would have become an OBGYN. And my idea of women's health was beyond the bikini area. It was beyond the area of reproduction. And I really wanted to delve into the differences between men and women. And so then I sought a fellowship, so advanced training after my internal medicine residency in women's heart disease. And that's where my interest in the intersect between hormones and heart disease came into play. And originally my goal was to really master the area of menopause, until I realized that there was a lot of research in that area. And we needed to take about two decades or three decades step back and understand what was happening during reproduction. And so we chartered a few studies and we looked at women who were stopping having their periods and coming in for symptoms of chest pain and during my fellowship. And we identified that about, you know, close to 70% of them were stopping having their periods, were coming in with what we call blockages in their heart and was concerning for heart disease. And these mm-hmm. were women in their 40s now. So this, what was happening now in their 40s was something that was preceding in their 20s and 30s. So we really took a deep dive into that. And that's where my interest really started, to understand what was happening to women at an early age in reproduction.
Uh-huh. Fascinating. So in No Period Now What, I mentioned potential heart-related issues that could occur because of amenorrhea, which at the time were mostly derived from studies who were postmenopausal. So you were quite involved in a lot of that research. Is this a reasonable comparison?
Well, the only comparison that we have is that women with have secondary amenorrhea due to FHA or REDS or along those lines have low estrogen. As women with menopause have low estrogen. The only difference is we're looking at aging, right? There's a difference in aging, young women versus older women. And but is it a fair comparison? And I would argue that it's not, because first and foremost, there's the physiological menopause is normal and natural. It's a healthy part of aging, and women live about 50% of their adult life after menopause. So there's something to be said about women who enter menopause naturally, and how we treat hot flashes and night sweats due to low estrogen, as opposed to a young woman who abruptly stops their menstrual cycle, and where that estrogen level is low, but they're not experiencing hot flashes, or they're probably not experiencing night sweats. And so there's other symptoms involved. So I think the comparison is there because it's low estrogen. But I think in the condition of HA, this is well beyond estrogen. This is a very much, I call this a physiological metabolic complex disorder. So there's more things that are up, there's more things that are down, there's more things that are beyond estrogen alone. And originally, I was a little naive going into this research, thinking it was all about estrogen. I'd been studying estrogen in postmenopausal women. So obviously, you know, that's where my comfort zone was. But in doing the research over the last decade, I now realize this is way beyond estrogen. It's a lot more complex. So is it a fair comparison? On some levels it is, but on most of them it isn't.
Well, I was sort of talking in terms of the heart-associated effects, because it seems pretty clear that there's an increase in cardiovascular disease post-menopause. Is that accurate?
After menopause, one in three women have heart disease.
So is it fair to say then that there are similar heart-related concerns with somebody who has amenorrhea premenopausal, or what would you say the differences would be?
So the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes, because we do see low estrogen levels promote things like dysfunctional blood vessels that should be expanding and they're not expanding because they need estrogen to promote that expansion. So when your heart rate goes up or when you need to exercise, those blood vessels should be widening open like a nice rubber band does. But at the same time, when you don't have estrogen, it doesn't have the gas pedal to open up. So in terms of that, it's correct. And in terms of some changes that we see with cholesterol, that is also correct because we see there's an impact of how cholesterol affects the good cholesterol. We see a lot of good cholesterol when estrogen's around. When estrogen levels lower, we see bad cholesterol start to creep up and good cholesterol start to creep down. And so those are truly related to what I would call ovarian changes. But in terms of postmenopausal changes related to heart disease, they're all not there in young women because there are things associated with just chronological aging, which we can't prevent. But we do see that as opposed to women who are young that abruptly stop. So there is it's a yes connection, but there's not all of them are there.
Could you give us a quick review of the potential heart-related issues that could occur in someone who is amenorrheic? And are those related to the length of time that, the person doesn't have a period for?
Yeah, so this is an area that we have been just flat out say this is an area we need more research on in terms of the length of amenorrhea. And I'm studying that right now in terms of trying to identify. And the other thing about amenorrhea in young women is there's recall bias, right? Women kind of forget how long they've had amenorrhea. So it's challenging. And so the idea is to study kind of going forward in terms of a prospective study in terms of trying to understand when a woman stops her period and then going forward, is the length of time that a woman gets her period back impacting her heart health? I mentioned the stretchiness of the blood vessels, and that's actually what we've been studying to an extensive level to determine if there is an association with this condition with blood vessels. And I mentioned that estrogen is important. It's the gas pedal for dilating blood vessels when your body is signaling your body to dilate. And there's and this is what we've in fact been studying and trying to determine giving back estrogen in a form of a patch or a pill. Would that actually then mitigate some of those changes? Of course, we want a woman to naturally get back her period, but could it be a bridge to treatment, which is what the Endocrine Society has somewhat called out and recommended if a woman's not had a period for 6 months? But the research really does focus on the fact that we see changes in cholesterol after a woman stopped having her period. We've actually started to see a signal for blood sugar challenges in terms of insulin resistance and blood sugar, not frank diabetes, but what we would consider would be an early signal or pre-diabetes in women that have this condition. And then the other thing to say is that what we are delving into is the vascular dysfunction. So this is that rubber band not working, not stretching up. And this is arteries that are throughout your whole body. It doesn't necessarily have to be in your heart. It can actually be in other parts of your bodies as well, because all blood vessels act the same. And if not having estrogen in your body then doesn't allow your blood vessels to relax and become a little bit stiffer, is that the first in the signal to then 30 years from now be at a higher risk for heart disease? And that's what we're answering. And that's what we're looking at. And does the role of how you get HA, what's the cause of HA, and what is the length of HA in terms of how of this condition? And it appears from our first study that we just concluded for 5 years that I'll be presenting at our upcoming Endocrine Society meeting in Atlanta, that about a third of women are getting this really stiff blood vessel dysfunction that have this condition. So it's not everybody. But the next question is,
a third is still quite a large number.
And we compared them to women who are getting their menstrual cycles. So it's a direct comparison. And then we took a third group and compared them to recently menopausal women who didn't have estrogen. The control group that had their menstrual cycles every month regularly, and we confirmed that they were ovulating by blood tests, those women did not have endothelial, any vascular dysfunction. And then the recently menopausal women who entered menopause naturally also didn't have any dysfunction. So that tells me it's separate from aging and it's separate from estrogen. And by the way, the women that had their menstrual cycles every month, we actually measured their blood vessel dysfunction testing, their vascular testing, on days 3 through 5 of their menstrual cycles when we know estrogen is at its lowest. Because what we didn't want to do is measure it when they were at their peak estrogen, because then you would say that's biasing the data. Maybe having so much estrogen around would do that. So So a third is a lot. I would completely agree with you. And it's a lot for a young, healthy woman who looks healthy, who is right. walking daily around, you know, the walking quote unwell. They look well, but they might be the walking unwell. So we need to get to the bottom of it and really pound out and identify who are getting this condition and what can we do about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had mentioned cholesterol earlier. With the elevation in cholesterol, what does that do to the heart? If somebody has sort of mildly elevated cholesterol, what are the concerns there?
So heart disease, there's five main causes of heart disease there's traditional risk factors for heart disease, meaning these are things that over time you can develop heart disease. And when I mean heart disease, it either means blocked blood vessels, a heart attack, which is a full blockage of the heart, which causes your heart to actually go into dysfunction. But there's five traditional risk factors. One is family history. One is high cholesterol. One is high blood pressure. One is diabetes. And one is smoking. So those are traditional risk factors. And we've identified a lot of risk factors that are we call non-traditional, which should be considered traditional for women. But you can see of those five, these five both affect men and women. And cholesterol, I mentioned, is one of those. So roughly, it's about 20% of each. Luckily, smoking cessations are done. We've done a tremendous job in this country, but there is a smaller group, especially of young women that are still having a difficult time stopping smoking. But we can see that each one of these kind of make up 20%. We also have genetics there, so that kind of takes into a bigger chunk. But so cholesterol could increase your risk for heart disease. What does that mean? The cholesterol, the way that I think about it is you've got your good cholesterol, your H cholesterol, HDL, which I term healthy cholesterol, and you've got your LDL, which is the bad cholesterol or the lousy cholesterol. So H and L. So you'll never forget it now. And
that's a really helpful way to remember which is which.
It's hard to remember these things. And these are little cues they teach us in med school. So there's my medical school education right there. and then you have other fractions of the cholesterol, which are triglycerides, which are kind of the instant fat that go into the bloodstream. And that's why we measure your cholesterol when you haven't eaten for 8 hours or fasting. Mm-hmm. So basically cholesterol are fat globules that kind of roam around through the body. They are metabolized through the liver. They're made through the liver. They're cleared out through the liver. They're cleared out also through our gut and our GI tract. But if you have a high number of them around, our body is trying to get rid of them. And what happens is that they can lay down and become the paving stones inside of blood vessels. Now, for transient points of time, if you don't have it for a prolonged period of time, seems to be a risk factor, but it's something if your family history is your thermostat set a little bit high and these were the cards you were dealt, over time that can potentially become the paving stones and then allow other cholesterol to layer on top of them. Mm-hmm. And in a small blood vessel, you can imagine that that's a problem because then instead of having a full blood vessel open, about half of it is blocked with cholesterol. And that's really the backbone of heart disease. So, those are traditional risk factors. So that's why cholesterol is on our radar. And that's why it's important. It's recommended to screen a young woman for cholesterol, but not regularly, not routinely, unless there's high cholesterol in your family. So,
Yeah. So it's very interesting. I've because the recommendations are not to screen cholesterol that often. I haven't seen good data on this, but I've certainly noticed in a couple of people that I've worked with that their cholesterol will be quite high when they have amenorrhea and then decrease significantly after they have recovered. Is that something that you folks are testing in your studies at all?
We actually are in, our blood is getting analyzed right now for cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So I will be able to tell you because we followed women for 3 months and we measured their cholesterol level over that period of time. But you're right. That signal is true related. We see that after menopause, and this is where the menopause research really does help. After menopause, as early as 3 months, we can start to see that low estrogen levels bring back the lousy cholesterol, the LDL up, and it can bring the HDL or the healthy cholesterol down. We also see a trend towards triglycerides start to go up after menopause as well. So that's where a low estrogen state can really parallel back to this secondary amenorrhea in women with HA. So think about that. As early as 3 months, we start to see impacted cholesterol. And so that gives us some signal that you know, these are changes that are occurring pretty rapidly. And because 3 months is not a long period of time. The other thing that's really interesting and parallels with that is the bone health data. So we do see bone health impact at 3 months as well. So 3 months seems to be that kind of early signal. And so we start to see those changes occur. But then what do we see going forward for a woman who's had amenorrhea for years or, you know, more than several months beyond 3 months? And we did ask that in our study, and we are looking at it. It's hard to, without a huge group of women, it's really hard to hone in because we don't have what we call the power to analyze months right. of amenorrhea associated with certain conditions. And this is why there's a call for action for more research. We need databases. Uh-huh. We need registries of women. And this is where women with this condition are, you need to step forward and say, look, this is not right. This is not yeah. good. We need to study young women. And we need yeah. to study this condition because guess what? It's very common. This is mm-hmm. not, this is, and it, even though it's transient and it's reversible, thankfully, what you're doing during that period can impact your long-term health.
Mm-hmm. And I think really getting that message out to sort of general physicians, I think is really helpful because there's, you know, it seems that there's a lot of teaching in med school, at least there used to be, that, you know, oh, period doesn't really matter. And, you know, I think the fact that more people are recognizing that it does is great, but there's still a lot of people that I work with whose doctors are like, oh, you don't have a period, that's no big deal. Like, it doesn't really matter. And, you know, it's just nice to keep hearing from people like you who are really researching this, that yes, it does matter. It is important. And it is something that we should be focusing on and not just brushing under the rug.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's where my soapbox gets started in terms of our society and how we treat our menstrual cycles in terms of being able to talk about it. I mean, my calling is that the menstrual cycle needs to be a vital sign, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the doctors check your blood pressure. They ask what your medications are when you go into the doctor's office. You might be with and the only person that really asked when your last menstrual cycle was is the OBGYNs. And that's because they want to make sure you're not pregnant. But, yeah. you know, we should be asking not only what was your last menstrual cycle, but are your menstrual cycles regular and do you get them every month? This is something that we should be asking at internal medicine doctor's appointments, gastro doctor's appointments, and, you know, mm-hmm. and beyond. And now we have the electronic health record. So this could be a simple fix. If doctors were required to enter this information, it will give us so much information in terms mm-hmm. of our steps for research. So, but no doctors really, we don't really focus on that, right? You're getting in, you're getting out, you're getting blood pressure checked. But menstrual cycle should be a part of your doctor's visit.
Hear, hear. So I know that you've recently completed a study on heart health and estrogen replacement, and you're recruiting for another one. So can you tell us a bit about these?
Yes. So this is where, if you live in the United States, this is our tax dollars at work. So this is where we're getting funded by the government, by the NIH. So there's not a conflict of interest there. But this is where finally the research is stepping up and coming up to date. We've studied older women with estrogen. We've studied perimenopausal women with estrogen. We're now starting to study pregnancy-related conditions, which is high estrogen, obviously. And now we're studying uh-huh. younger women who've stopped having their menstrual cycle and due to HA. So the initial study that we just completed was a 5-year study. I was the principal investigator on that. And that was really to determine, is there such thing as a vascular dysfunction in women with HA? And that's where we started to see comparing to normal women. Well, I call them normal. I mean, they're just control groups. They're women who are self-identified of having no chronic diseases, and they get their menstrual cycles every month. So are they normal? They're getting their menstrual cycles monthly. And then comparing them to recently menopausal women. Now, all three groups could not be on any hormones. So obviously, we don't want women on birth control pills. We don't want women on hormone replacement therapy, because we want to identify, is it just estrogen or is it beyond? So that's where we found that 1/3 of women with HA really did have this atypical pattern of the vascular function and vascular dysfunction. The interesting thing is we also looked at the immune cells. So we looked at cytokines, which are kind of they're the troops that kind of go out there and fight infection. And mm-hmm. there's inflammation my markers of these cytokines. These are a part of our immune function. You might have heard some of these being talked about with the recent COVID infections and how women actually do better from COVID than men. And it has a lot to do with our cytokines. We're actually, we develop a better immune response than men when it comes to diseases or disorders. So we measure these cytokines, inflammation cytokines, and then anti-inflammation cytokines, because there's a whole group of cytokines that actually help inflammation as well. They're against inflammation. So we identify that women also with HA probably has more to do with estrogen, had a trend towards more inflammation cytokines. So, but not the anti-inflammation. Your anti-inflammation cytokines, so the ones that are blocking the inflammation, are still there. So that's good for COVID. But the ones that are pro-inflammation seem to be more tipped in the wrong direction for women with HA. So that was our first initial study. And then we gave women back a patch of estrogen, just the group of HA, 30 women, a patch of high dose, what we consider a hormone replacement therapy, but 0.1 of the patch, if you know those doses. And we gave it to them unopposed for 3 weeks, 3 months straight, to see does giving a woman back estrogen, if they have a dysfunction, reverse that dysfunction. I haven't done the formal presentation analysis for that because we're still doing it, but I can tell you that we didn't really see a signal. So we didn't see a signal. If a woman has vascular dysfunction, giving them back estrogen alone, it doesn't really change it. I think, but yeah, you know, the rubber band has been stretched too thin, you know, that stretchy rubber band, and giving a small dose of estrogen back for only 3 months didn't pull back in that estrogen band. So, or didn't pull it back in that rubber band. So the vascular dysfunction really didn't get impacted by the estrogen that we saw, but that's research undergoing right now, not ready for prime time, but I can give you a sneak peek. The next study that we're doing is also a long study funded by the NIH. There was a research call to do fertility as a marker for future health. So we know that fertility is reproduction. Young women should be reproductive, whether they want to have a child or not at that time. This is all about reproductive aging. And so the government wanted to look, and the NIH wanted to look specifically as, are there markers that are happening during fertility that could predict future health? Well, in essence, HA is a marker for future health. And specifically, it is infertility, because you can't get pregnant during this condition. And you have to, a lot of women really recognize it when they're seeking to get pregnant, right? The good news is you can get pregnant having this condition. It's not an infertility long-term, and it's not a barrier, but it is a barrier for that period of time that you're not getting your period. So I submitted research grant to that call for action for research. And it was very well accepted based on the initial study and based on the fact that we need to further identify who are the women getting this vascular dysfunction. Is it the over-exercisers? Is exercising without estrogen not, you know, everyone presumes exercise is excellent because you're promoting nitric oxide, so you're vasodilating all your blood vessels, you're making them more stretchy. But if you don't have the gas pedal to make that blood vessel stretchy, is exercising without estrogen in your body, you know, taking one step forward, but really two steps back. So that's the first thing to identify. The second thing to identify, is it the women who are very clean eaters or very controlled with their eating, just eating caloric intake, you know, expenditure. So that's a component of it. And then the third one is to look at stress and to look at the role of stress that stress plays in our body. And I'm not saying that, you know, this is a very complex, and I think one of the reasons why it hasn't been studied as much, because it's not as clear cut as like, okay, measure blood pressure, and then we get an outcome. Because the conditions that impact women at such a young age that cause this condition, that cause the access to the ovary to shut down, is beyond just one condition. It's an overlap. And so the research that I'm doing over the next 4 years involves a Fitbit. It mm-hmm. involves questionnaires. And it involves vascular testing at four different points in time over three months only. And it involves measuring those inflammation markers and cortisol and stress markers. So,
okay, I can ask about how you measure the stress.
It's to put the whole picture together to try to mm-hmm. understand and really what we call phenotype, which is physically characterize who's getting this condition related back to the vascular dysfunction. Because if we can then say, okay, it's this condition specifically, we can then address it and teach the doctors to then identify it and not just say this is a condition, put everyone on birth control pills, because that's currently happening.
Yeah. So you are currently recruiting for this study, correct?
Yes. So it's happening right now in Los Angeles. We will be moving the study excitingly to Jacksonville, Florida, because I will be joining the Mayo Clinic as a chair in terms of women's health leadership there. And so the first part of the study right now will be done in Los Angeles. So the other nice thing about this is that we're going to have bicoastal data. Part of this, because part of the awareness is to understand that this isn't just related to one specific demographic or one specific area. It's related. It's all across the world that this condition is happening. And I would liken the fact that it's probably increasing now, especially related to things that are happening due to the pandemic. So I think fallout of COVID has really probably brought this probably more forefront. So right now we are recruiting. It is a low risk study because there's nothing, we are not giving medications. We're doing vascular testing, which is all non-invasive. So nothing goes into the body. It's blood pressure cuffs and ultrasounds. And the exciting thing is that we are using Fitbits to collect sleep data, heart rate variability, heart rate data, step count, exercise count. And then we are measuring weight. We are giving a Fitbit scale for the study, but we're not relating the weight to the condition. We're relating the weight back to the vascular health. And so all of these things are going to go into the pieces of the puzzle. The nice thing is for women that want to participate, we do give them at the end, as part of the research, their Fitbit to keep. So they get to keep their Fitbit watch. It's a nice watch. And then there's a stipend for coming in for your time. So that's the exciting part. We're recruiting 100 women. So we need the boots on the ground to tell women about this study. And if they're local in the area of Los Angeles, we are getting the word out right now. And then the other thing to say is once we hit in the fall, we'll be starting in Jacksonville, Florida. So this is all important research and important recognition by the NIH that this is a serious condition that we need more information about.
So I have put a little link together for people who are interested in learning more about the study. So they can go to http://noperiod.info/heart-study. So for anyone who's listening, you can go there and get to the study page and hopefully come and join the study, and we can learn some more about you and everyone else who's participating.
Yeah, the other easy thing to remember is the phone number. It's our area code is just 310-423-9666. Horrible number, but easy to remember. So women can call that number too. And I'm happy to go through any further information about the study if women want to join.
Fantastic. So doctors will often recommend either hormone replacement therapy or oral contraceptives to people with amenorrhea. We generally suggest in No Period Now What and our work with clients that recovering natural cycles is better if possible. Mm-hmm. So what are the most important factors for people to consider from your perspective as they weigh the options of restoring natural cycles versus contraception versus hormone replacement therapy? Like, what are some of the things that you would encourage people to think about?
Well, first off is that women can have an ovulatory cycle before they achieve their menstrual cycles back. If a woman doesn't desire to get pregnant, then that needs to be taken into consideration. And I know a lot of your book does talk about regaining that cycle for fertility function, which is so important. But I would agree 100%, if not more, that the replacing estrogen with a birth control pill or a outside of contraception or a hormone replacement therapy is a band-aid. We need these conditions to come back. And whenever I enroll women in these studies, I say, continue doing what you're doing to regain your period back. And if you need contraception, then a birth control pill is important to use because you could ovulate and get pregnant or do a second other forms of birth control. It's not necessarily about the birth control pill. And certainly there's a lot of women that might not be even able to take that form of contraception. But with all of that being said, even if you look at the Endocrine Society guidelines, they say if a woman's had amenorrhea for 6 or more months, that then they could use a low dose of a birth control pill they actually say hormone replacement therapy. So a patch or a pill of low estrogen. Now, what is the difference and why would they say hormone replacement therapy versus a birth control pill? And there's a big difference between the two. Hormone replacement therapy is estradiol. So that's actually, or synthetic estrogen, but it's estrogen mm-hmm. that your ovary used to make. It's considered bioidentical and it's similar in structure to what your ovary's been making all these years. So that's why they use hormone replacement therapy and to give it back at a dose that would be kind of similar to what a woman, a young woman should be making. And that was that 0.1 patch I mentioned. Hormone birth control pills are all synthetic and their estrogen levels are way up here as opposed to hormone replacement therapy that's down here. And the purpose of birth control pills is to suppress ovulation. Women with this condition already have suppressed ovulation. So that's where the two different play a role. But I would wholeheartedly agree with you that this is a condition where we should be identifying the cause and supporting the underlying treatment to reverse it. Uh-huh. So absolutely.
Great. Thank you. So we had a discussion with Dr. Kate Ackerman a few months ago, and we talked about the fact that for bone density purposes, the patch hormone replacement therapy is probably better than oral because of the avoidance of the first pass metabolism in the liver that occurs when hormones are taken orally. Is the same true for the heart's health in terms of the hormone replacement patch probably being better for physiological replacement of estrogen than taking the oral contraceptives?
This is another one dating going back to the menopause research that where we've learned that the route of delivery likely matters. It matters for bone health, but it also matters for heart health as well. So in women that are, I'm going to speak to menopause right now, we use the patch of estrogen because oral estrogens first metabolize in the liver, as mentioned for the bone. And that metabolism outside of bone health now, specific to heart health, it can increase inflammation. And in some women can increase clotting cascade. So that's where there's a preferential effect for the patch in women that are kind of high risk for heart disease at menopause. Now, in a young woman with HA, would it be a condition that you could then relate to the same challenges? But my role here is to say, going transdermally or going through the skin, you get more of a physiological ratio of what your body used to make. So for a woman with HA that needs to use the estrogen, giving her back a physiological condition as opposed to a non-physiological dosing is much more beneficial. And we've seen it on the bone health. We are looking at it on the heart health, but that's where my role comes in terms of what we know now and what we know today. So I think that it's a very important point because route of delivery and dose does matter.
Okay. Yeah. So I've been looking at research recently that finds that the continuous oral contraceptives are better for bone density than oral contraceptives with a monthly bleed. And the theory seems to be because you're actually getting estrogen for more of the month. So you don't have that placebo week where where basically the estrogen is dropping. Do you have or know of any data on that issue with respect to heart health? Would that sort of monthly drop in estrogen be equally bad in terms of heart health as it is for bone health?
Well, and interestingly enough, the whole history of birth control pills is really interesting because that week of placebo pills is a false bleed. It is a false withdrawal bleed. And it's by design put in there so women don't think they're pregnant. So there is no real need to do a physiological drop. However, if you do give a woman a pill back to back to back to back, which can be done, occasionally they will start having what we call breakthrough bleeding, which is they'll have a regular spotting. But you know, now we've got birth control pills that are on the market that are actually dosed 3 months at a time.
Yeah.
Do we have data specific to heart disease in terms of the cardiovascular impact of doing back-to-back pills? We do not. And I've done a deep dive into the research and have published state-of-the-art papers on this topic. But I will say that if you look at the interesting thing is that heart conditions, and this isn't specific to young women, but heart conditions that are specific to women do occur generally during that placebo week when estrogen levels drop. So we do see a signal for things like heart attacks during the estrogen drop. So there is probably a very strong physiological change when you go from a high estrogen level, dropping it down to a low estrogen level. And so that's an area that does need to be researched. I will say that it's difficult to research because birth control pills are different doses. We have different generations. They have different progestogens, which is the estrogen, progestogen. There's a second birth control pills just aren't estrogen. They have a progestin in them too. And there's been many different generations of progestins. The estrogens have all kind of stayed the same. The doses of the estrogen have changed, but the progestin hasn't. So how that impacts, we've looked at that specifically to on the heart rhythm itself. We've looked at different EKG changes, and we do see a change with the different progestogens that are used. Oh, wow. But the back-to-back birth control has not been studied. And I think it's only really been recently discussed as being an option, especially with the recent formulations that allow you to take it for 3 months at a time. So,
yep. So moving on to a basically completely different topic, you've written articles commenting on the sexism in heart disease evaluation. Can you tell us what people should be aware of on this front? Like, are there specific symptoms or factors that our listeners who are mostly premenopausal females should be looking out for that they might not sort of know based on the sort of traditional heart disease in men sort of paradigm?
Yes. I've written about the misogyny of obesity in our society and the sexism of heart disease itself. And that really does come down to the fact that medical school training is literally, when I learned about a heart attack, it was by a very famous illustrator called Dr. Netter. And he wrote of a man, they would illustrate different clinical scenarios. It was a man clutching his chest in a snowstorm as he's shoveling snow, and he's probably around the age of 70. So that's the message that we are teaching, not hopefully now, but 20 years ago, we're teaching doctors. So that tells you right there that heart attacks only happen in men. They only happen in older men, and they only happen when they're shoveling snow or on the golf course. I mean, literally, that was like the message that I got. The other thing we've really tried to steer away from is the Hollywood heart attack. The Hollywood heart attack is not the heart attack we see in women. Clutching your chest, falling to the ground. I cannot tell you how many, you know, fabulous movies are out there that do illustrate men having heart attacks in that way. Yet they don't illustrate when, you know, a woman has a heart attack. Women's symptoms tend to be milder. They tend to be, they predominantly are chest pain, but they might be less, they're not like an elephant sitting on the chest. Mm-hmm. They might have jaw pain. They might have back pain. They might be nauseous. They might even have epigastric pain. Like they've actually have an ulcer or something, you know, they ate something wrong or they just can't get comfortable because they're short of breath. They can't catch a breath. So these are milder symptoms that kind of encompass women's heart disease. So there's been a real calling in the last two decades to recognize that while chest pain is a common symptom of heart disease, that women have what I hate the term atypical, but that's what's been coined as atypical chest pain, because these aren't atypical in women. These are typical.
Right.
And so those are the signs and symptoms of heart disease. And I've actually been called by emergency room doctors that say, oh, your patient's in the emergency room. She's got some, you know, this, that, and the other symptoms, you know, should we admit her? And I'm like, well, she's already had a heart attack. So yes, you should admit her. So these are signs and symptoms that we need to be aware of. Now, risk factors for heart disease specific to younger women are also important, because I mentioned the five traditional risk factors that also encompass the high cholesterol, and those cross over between men and women. But we know that there are sex specific risk factors specifically to women. We know what happened, and a lot of them. So stress and depression, women that have frank depression, that can be a risk factor for heart disease. We used to think that if you had high blood pressure during pregnancy and it resolved after pregnancy, then it went away. But we know that what happens during pregnancy doesn't stay during pregnancy anymore. We see the impact on the heart health as soon as 5 to 10 years after delivery of the baby. So there's this whole calling to make women aware that adverse pregnancy outcomes, which is, you know, gestational diabetes during pregnancy, high blood pressure during pregnancy, entering pregnancy with high blood pressure, but maintaining it during pregnancy, you know, going into pregnancy, going into early labor, or what we call premature labor, and delivering the baby early, having preeclampsia, which is an overwhelming inflammation that forces a woman to deliver. Those are also things that can impact. And then the other thing to say is that the menstrual cycle, I mean, we know that we're studying it, and should the menstrual cycle be a vital sign, like I mentioned, for heart health. And so those are the traditional risk factors beyond, there's more specific to women. And I will say that there's another one that we're really looking at now is autoimmune disorders. So autoimmune disorders are more common in women. About 80% of autoimmune, and these are things like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's. These are things like you might have heard about, but you need to think about them more at the forefront, because women actually get more of them than men. There's actually a biological reason for that, because where our immune markers are on the X chromosome. So women have two X chromosomes. And while that puts us at an advantage for inflammation, fighting COVID infections or other infections, it can put us at a disadvantage when our body kind of overregulates those genes and makes more autoimmune disorders, because our body isn't recognizing ourselves. So that's one of the reasons women get more autoimmune disorders. But all of those, autoimmune is parallel with inflammation, and then that can be a risk factor for heart disease. So, So yes, it's beyond, you know, the traditional risk factors for women. And there's a lot more. And I'm sure in the next decade, we'll learn about many more to come.
Yeah. So if somebody has some of those risk factors, what would that sort of mean for their like daily existence? Or, you know, would it just mean like a little bit additional workup at their annual physician's appointment? Like what would sort of ongoing maintenance or whatever for that look like?
Yeah. So this is where knowledge is power, right? I mean, if you know you have one of these risk factors, you might say, you know, you might think about going into just your general internal medicine doctor, as opposed to your OBGYN for your well women exam or your annual exam, and say, you know, I have these risk factors. I had an adverse pregnancy outcome, or I had, you know, I have this in my family. My mother has autoimmune. I think I might have autoimmune. Any of those that I mentioned, but it might be a little bit more proactive. This is where women really, really need to really speak up, because it might just go overseen. And, you know, the fact of the matter is a lot of doctors out there in the community might not know it. I mean, think about my training, going back to the Netter image of the man clutching the heart for heart disease. Yeah. These are novel risk factors, which means they're new and they're emerging. So people that aren't in this space and aren't doing research on it aren't thinking about it. They're thinking about your traditional risk factors and getting you in and getting you out. But everything with heart disease comes back to knowing your numbers, knowing your cholesterol numbers, knowing your high blood pressure, your blood pressure numbers, knowing your body mass index, knowing your, so those are the traditional things that you should know, and then to get evaluated. And if you have some of these, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to end up with heart disease. That's not what I'm saying, but it means that you need to stay more vigilant on top of your numbers.
So would it be getting an EKG at this annual visit, or what would be the clinical things that you should be doing?
The clinical pearl would be, we don't screen everybody for an EKG. We don't screen everybody for an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, but it is to know your numbers, to go in and make sure that you've been evaluated and know your cholesterol, know your blood pressure, things beyond that. And then hopefully in the future, we'll be able to say, okay, and out of Dr. Shufeldt's research, we want you to measure this inflammation marker or this cytokine, because, you know, this is where the research is going. It's precision medicine, which means that it is individualized to you. And it is not just about, here's a template and check off all the boxes that you need to get. It's about, I have this condition, and I've had this exposure, and therefore here's your new template of precision medicine labs that you need. So I think the field is moving in that direction. We're just not there yet, but hopefully out of this research, we will be. So for now, the pearl is to know your numbers and to get in and be evaluated, and to teach your doctors, if they don't know, that these are conditions that are specific to women.
Great. Thank you. So second to last question, we use the term all in to describe our general method for recovering missing periods. So eating enough, cutting out high intensity exercise, working on the stress and mental side. But we like to take the term a bit further sometimes. So we ask our guests, what are you all in your work or your life right now?
Oh boy. So all in to me, obviously I'm all in with the passion for this research. I'm all into research. I'm all into women's health. And if you stop me in the hallway or I have a patient visit, I love to talk about where we can move this field forward. So that's why I'm all in with that. And you know, but with all in, you know, there's this whole adage of you don't want to have burnout, right? Because you're just all in. You have to have that work-life balance. So being all in at home is also important because I've got a small family, I got a small children, and being all in for that. So that's where I see the message of all in goes. But I do, you know, after 2 years of COVID and after being moved to different areas of the hospital, we have to really embrace that. It's okay at some point to kind of step back and be more about you and me and really kind of, you know, we give so much of ourselves as women. I always say women are the upside down triangle. You know, you've got the food pyramid. We've got the food pyramid where you want to eat less of whatever's at the top and you want to have all these healthy vegetables and fruits. But women are really the upside down triangle. We're kind of the smallest pyramid of the triangle at the bottom, but we're holding up everybody else. Mm-hmm. We're holding up our community, our workplace, our family. So I think all in also means that it needs to be all in and all about you too. So making sure I get that, you know, exercise at the gym so that I get to my trainer or I get to get on the treadmill at the end of the day and just decompress. So all in also means that, you know, being there for my family and enjoying the times that I have with my family, but also taking the time to, you know, read a nice book.
So tell us where people can find you if they're interested in participating in your trial or interested in learning more about your research. So we do have you had mentioned your phone number earlier. You can give that again if that would be helpful.
So I'm very active on Twitter. I really love to post the most upcoming research specific to women. And I only do vetted sources that are very well, you know, evidence-based and not mm-hmm. something hocus pocus. So I will say that it's at C. Schufelt, MD is my Twitter handle. You can follow me on Twitter. You can also call that phone number for the research itself. It's 310-423-9666. Right now, my academic appointment and title is at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. And if you live, you know, more than two counties away from Los Angeles County, we can also help provide some travel stipend for the funding for research. So it will cover the cost of traveling to our center to do the research, but it's an added benefit that we have while we're here at Cedars-Sinai. In the fall, I will be transitioning to be the chair of the Division of Internal Medicine and Women's Health. Is housed in internal medicine, so that's the beauty, at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Mm-hmm. And so I will be moving this research, as I mentioned, to Florida. So that will be also available to people that are interested in. And so the connection there would be the Twitter. The connection would also be what I lightly term Dr. Google. You just go to Google and just put in my name. But don't look up all medical conditions because Dr. Google doesn't have an MD at the end of the day. So
absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Cassandra. And I really appreciate your work and everything that you're doing.
I really do appreciate everything you do on your end and all the women out there that are putting a name and a face to this condition and really bringing the moving things forward. We need to do it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a lovely day. Bye.
Bye.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please take a few minutes to reflect on it and think how you have been all in this past week or few weeks. It always strikes me how different each person's all-in journey is. As I often say, there are many paths to HA and many paths out of it. Your journey is unique.
That is so true. And if you need more support on your journey, you should definitely start with No Period Now What, which you can get at noperiod.info/book.
You can also go to noperiod.info/appointments to schedule a time to speak with me on understanding your blood work, fixing issues underlying your missing periods, and for guidance around fertility treatments, pregnancy, and post-recovery changes.
And visit beyondbodyimage.com/work-with-me to connect with me to overcome the fear of weight gain and finally develop healthy coping mechanisms around stress and your relationship with food, exercise, and your body. Remember, we also have joined clients, so you can access both our domains of expertise within a common coaching package of sessions available from both our websites.
Also, join the No Period Now What Recovery Support Group at noperiod.info/support and let us know how online is going for you. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast and found it helpful, please drop us a review on iTunes to help more people find it.
All in, it's not just about period recovery, it's about getting your life back. See you in 2 weeks.
You were lost in Babylon, till you got lost again. You were lost in Babylon, now find yourself and then. Take all that you've learned about what love and loss, pleasure and pain, and never get lost. Never get lost again.